Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Hello there, I'm Chuck Todd, and this is the Chuck Todd Cast. And joining me now is Josh Rogan. He's a columnist for the Washington Post, but he's author of the new book called Chaos Under Heaven, Trump, Chi, and the Battle for the 21st Century. It's a really interesting new book. I have been poring through it. It's a very deeply reported book. It's not a extended column, so people need to understand that. But it was really interesting. I was, Josh, Chaos Under Heaven. I thought, I wonder where he gets this title. And then you go in the book and it's like, oh, it's Mao. Okay. When something doesn't quite make sense, you attribute it to Mao. But why did you pick that Maoism?
Right. So the quote, full Mao quote, and by the way, Chuck, thanks for having me on the Toddcast. The full Mao quote is, there is chaos under heaven. The situation is excellent, right? And what's funny about that is that, you know, it sort of aptly describes what I detected to be the situation in the Chinese leadership, which was that the chaos and dysfunction that was roaring through our system over the last four years was definitely something that they enjoyed. At the same time, they kind of, you know, were scared of it because they didn't really know what was going to happen next. And, you know, the other funny thing is that Mao probably never said it. It's attributed to him in several different places, but we can never really figure it out, which kind of, you know, shows you never really know what's going on that side of the ocean. Now, the other Mao quote that I have in the book is one that John McCain would often say, and he would always say, it's always darkest before it goes completely black.
I quote him all the time on that one. Yeah,
the funny thing is that Mao definitely never said that. And while McCain didn't like the idea of quoting Mao, he loved the idea of misquoting Mao. But if he would only have known that at this point in time, after the Trump administration, that's where we are in U.S.-China relations. It's pretty dark. The things are looking pretty bleak at this moment.
You know, it's funny, after going through this book, and there's part of me wants to go through all the details first and then ask you this question, but I want to ask you this question on the front end.
Sure.
And that is, imagine all of the same people in their positions in the Trump White House and all of those advisors and all of those beliefs, but instead of Donald Trump as president, it's Mike Pence.
Right.
Where are we in U.S.-China relations?
Yeah, right. So great question. So, you know, the book is called Chaos Under Heaven because inside the Trump administration over these 4 years, there was just a ton of chaos. Factions fighting each other for the attention of the president and for control over the policy on everything, really, but specifically on China. And in that scheme, you know, some good things happened and some bad things happened. And U.S. foreign policy towards China changed in a fundamental way. And it was a crazy story. And I tried to report it out the best I could. Inside that story, Mike Pence had a very interesting role. He played a big part in U.S.-China relations at several points, but he was a hardliner. He's a cold warrior. He's a guy who thinks we need to do a lot more to confront the Chinese government on a range of fronts. And sometimes that policy won out, but sometimes in the Trump presidency, it didn't. So there you go.
Well, and I think that's because it really, you know, at the end of the day, I feel like that the entire, you know, you're painting a picture on one hand that says, oh, there was a lot of factions, and I'm sure there was degrees, but I feel like the biggest wild card was no policy person, but it was Trump himself and the weird personal the way he personalizes all his foreign relationships, which seemed to undermine what was, look, we can debate whether it's the right policy or not, but there was actually, it did seem to be on China, a coherent idea of what they wanted to do. It's just the president himself blew it up all the time.
Well, that's right. And you knew this because you covered that White House so well that, you know, there were always a strategy and then there was what Trump was going to do on any given day. But I don't think it's right to say that Trump didn't know what he wanted. He just didn't know how to get what he wanted. What he wanted was a deal. And he
What's the elusive deal?
That's you know, in a way, when they struck the trade deal in the January 15th, 2020, the day before the COVID information started to pour in, Trump made a speech and he said he wanted to reset U.S.-China trade relations, bring back the jobs. Now, of course, the deal doesn't actually do any of those things, but that was something that Trump had written about in his books. It was something that he talked about on the campaign trail. It's really consistent in a way. And so Trump really cared about this trade deal, and he really thought he had a really close relationship with Chinese President Xi Jinping. Now, what was awful about that was that Chinese President Xi Jinping used that friendship to manipulate Trump and to feed him with terrible information, especially about the pandemic. We can get to that later. But, you know, you did have those, as you just said, you had those two dynamics. You had a government and guys like Pence and Pompeo and O'Brien and Esper trying to do something on serious on China. And then you had Trump sort of floating above it, and he had a different goal. And because of his crazy behavior and because of his friendship with his good friend Xi, it got to be a mess. And that's what chaos is. That's the chaos under heaven.
It seems to me that we are at a we're at this interesting point. And look, and you and I are both of an age where we had to we've read more about U.S. Soviet conflicts rather than covered them.
Right.
I mean, the Soviet Union went away basically when I was just starting college. So but there seems to be something. It seems to be we're confronting the same point that Eisenhower, Kennedy and Johnson and Nixon at various times had to deal with, and even and all the presidents going through Reagan, which is, do you deal with the adversary as they are and get what right. you can, or do you try to change the adversary, right? Do you try right. to, and you know, this is, you know, I could tell you many a U.S. president would be criticized very quietly about during Soviet, you know, you didn't bring up the way they treat dissidents, and you didn't bring up this, and same thing happens with China. You didn't bring up the Uyghurs, or you didn't bring up this human rights violation or this democracy issue. And it seems as if we're at that point where we have to decide, what are we going to do? How much do we want to confront them? We
exactly.
can confront them as much as we want if we choose to, or we can figure out how to live with them and prosper if we choose to, or maybe we, or, you know, maybe there's another way, but it
right.
I feel like we don't know quite how to manage China yet. That's for
yeah. Sure. I think you're doing a really good job of putting your finger on the sort of sense in our country, not just in our government, but really around the world, that this issue of the U.S.-China relationship and how China behaves in the world is something that affects us, right? It's something that is no longer some faraway issue, and now it's part of our security and our public health and our media and our culture. And we sort of have to decide yeah, exactly what you said.
Where America, communism in the Soviet Union and it got well, into wars in Korea and Vietnam.
Yes. In other words, this will be a challenge on the scale of the Cold War, but I don't think we should call it a Cold War because it's not the Cold War. It's something different. And China is more integrated with the world than the Soviet Union was. It's going to be the biggest economy soon. So we can't have the Cold War the way that we
by the way,
it was
China
before. We shouldn't want to.
The
right?
Soviets had a terrible economy. So,
exactly.
war did, you know, the threat of war was like, well, it might be better than this economy.
Right,
China's
right.
got a great economy. They don't want a war to ruin it.
Right. And we don't want to divide the world into two. At the same time, we have to address the problems of the Chinese government's behavior as it rises. So I think what the way to explain it that I do put in the book is, you know, we have to put China to a choice, right? They can, if they're not going to change their worst behaviors, and again, those are the ones that sort of affect us, the theft of our knowledge and experience, the efforts to sort of expand militarily, how they dealt with COVID is part of this. If they're not going to change that, then we have to raise the costs and protect ourselves. And that's sort of the discussion. And we can go overboard and we shouldn't go overboard and we can't do everything and we don't have unlimited resources and we're going to have to find ways to cooperate with China. And that's complicated, you know, and that's, I think, the question that everyone in Washington, really everyone around the country, is grappling with, and there are no easy answers. And, you know, people will say, oh, well, we shouldn't have a Cold War. Of course, we shouldn't have a Cold War. Nobody wants that. But at the same time, we can't do nothing. So I think, you know, what you're putting your finger on is that, you know, somewhere in between a total Cold War and doing nothing about the problems with China's rise, that's where we have to figure out what we can do.
You know, with the Soviet Union, we knew that their economy was unsustainable. They
exactly.
were going to collapse. I have comforted myself, and I still do, in my belief that China's got bills to pay with its own people. There's going to be, you know,
absolutely.
I remember watching a documentary called, I think it was American Factory. And it, I don't know if you saw that, Josh. You may have. It was about this Chinese company that
I'm familiar with it.
Yeah, yeah, that starts a factory in Ohio,
right?
But the Chinese the expectations of the Chinese management versus the American management. You watch it, you realize, oh, they don't have a trial lawyer. Oh, they don't have labor unions. Oh, they don't have OSHA. Oh, right. They don't have, you know, and. So I remember walking away thinking that, you know, at the end of the day, this country is going to get bogged down with how it mistreats its own citizens. Like, that is going to be their great challenge in the next 20 years. And that is something that will bog them down. They may not let us see it, but it's going to create some internal strife. But I am starting to wonder if that is where with Soviets, time was on our side. Is time on our side on this one?
Right. You know, I think that, you know, China has great challenges and great internal challenges as it rises. And, you know, I think we need to, just as human beings who believe in human rights, stand up for those people who are being made to suffer atrocities. At the same time, you know, we have to sort of abandon this idea that we're going to make the Chinese like us, you know, and it's kind of been this hubristic American idea that, you know, these countries are going to turn into Jeffersonian democracies. I think China's development will be led by the Chinese people, one way or the other. And while we should encourage the outcomes that we believe are in the interest of humankind, we really have to focus on how China's growth affects us in our countries. And I mean, like, all the free and open societies. And I think that, you know, they have to sort of come together on, you know, a plan. And I think the first step of that plan has to be, and I don't think this is a controversial thing to say, to fix our democracy. And if we don't fix our system, then how can we compete? And if we don't live up to our values, then how can we preach them abroad to other people? So, you know, what we've had over the last 4 years is just dysfunction. And sometimes the China issue gets super politicized, and that's really bad. So, you know, I think this is going to be a long haul, right? And this is going to be a generational challenge. And we don't know what the end game will look like. But the goal has to be for us to find a way to have a relationship with China that both sides can live with, right, to avoid the conflict that neither side wants.
So, you know, and you begin the book by sort of painting a picture of an Obama administration that was trying too hard to establish a quid pro quo relationship.
Yep.
Explain where you think they were naive.
You know, it's like you said, is China going to be the priority in our foreign policy? You know, my book argues basically that it must be, that this is the most important thing in foreign policy. It's up there with, like, climate change and social justice as the big issues of our generation that we really have to focus on, and we have to get them right, you know? And what I reported and what a lot of other people reported was at the end of the Obama administration was that wasn't the priority. The priority was a climate change deal and, mm-hmm. you know, keep getting the Iran nuclear deal in place and cooperating on, you know, Afghanistan and all the other things and counter piracy and you name it, counter narcotics. And they thought this was sort of the last gasps of the idea that if we just engage with the Chinese Communist Party enough and we're just so, like, good at it and we're just so authentic about it, they're going to come around to our way of seeing things on a number of fronts. And even at that time, inside the Obama administration, there was a lot of competition and a lot of disagreement.
Right.
But at least at that moment, the engagers were winning the day. And that's what you see in the Biden administration now, is that the engagers are still there, literally the same people, but they're not winning the day. Actually, the people who are more competition focused, like Jake Sullivan and Tony Blinken and Kirk Campbell, they're the ones with the ball right now. They have the policy in their hands. And that's why you're seeing up more continuity from the Trump era than change, you know?
But, you know, well, yes, but there was one aggressive thing that they did, and ironically, our politics blew it up, and that was the TPP. I mean, the single most aggressive move the Obama people tried to put a check on China,
yep,
was the TPP, and abandoning it now, I mean, every year it looks like a worse decision.
Well, absolutely. From a strategic policy,
probably strategic standpoint. Art, yeah.
But look, you were there. Remember the politics of 2016.
Oh, I know. It was a mess.
And so Hillary Clinton said she wasn't for it, even though she was involved in.
Oh, no. It was the gold standard of trade agreements, wasn't it? I think she used that phrase.
Right.
Yeah.
So the politics of our country in 2016 were such that we had lost a lot of America who didn't feel the benefits of globalization. And this was kind of the feeling that the Trump campaign really tapped into in order to bring people into our politics. So, you know, TPP would have been great, I think, but, you know, that's the problem with putting the cart before the horse. First, you have to take care of Americans, then you can trade with the world. And I think, you know, both parties in Washington are guilty of sort of losing the thread on that basic idea right. that, you know, trade is great, but first, if Americans don't have jobs, then it's no good. And so I think both parties are reacting to that. So I don't think we can go back to TPP, but I think we need to move forward with a trade policy that reflects the needs of Americans as well as the needs of the people around the world.
Do you think this quad could be sort of how a revised TPP could get launched? You know, you start with these four powers of India, Australia, Japan, and the United States, and sort of things could grow out from that. Do you think this is a
Do you think
that Modi is too unpredictable to be partnering with here?
You know, what's fascinating is that when I did the reporting this week on the Quad, what the Biden people kept saying to me, frankly, was that the Indians were more on board than anyone else, that they've
who's had a fresh military confrontation with the Chinese?
Exactly.
The Indians.
So I think actually the reluctance is more on the Japanese side at this point. That's because they have a different calculation and a new government and they have to play it very carefully. But, you know, the Quad and ASEAN and the D10 and the T12 and the G7 all those things, they're all only as good as they are used, you know, and we just have to wait and see. I don't know if they're going to use it for vaccines. That's great. Everybody needs vaccines. After that, what are they going to use this thing to do something real, or is it just going to be another, you know, Zoom session? I just don't think we know the answer yet.
Yeah. I don't want to go off on a tangent here, but our management of India is going to be fascinating because we need them and they know we need them because they're an interesting check on China. But we may have to, if we didn't like, we may not like some of the ways Modi runs his democracy, but that's for another podcast. Look, I think one of the scoopier things that you have in here has to do with the virus, the Wuhan lab, and this sort of, you know, it's a theory that has not been disproven or proven, right? It's probably the best way to look at it, right? And it's this theory that was COVID a lab accident, I've heard it from Dr. Fauci. I've heard it that they believe everything they've looked at here says this occurred naturally. What is it that you found that at least calls this into some question?
Yeah. So to be clear, we don't know how the virus originated, right? And, you know, I'm not here to say we know one way or the other. And I don't think you know. I don't think Fauci knows. I don't think Joe Biden knows. I don't think Donald Trump knew. But what we had over the past year was this hyper-politicized debate over the origin of the virus, where, you know, the Chinese government first said it came from the seafood market, and then Pompeo and Trump said it came from the lab, and then the Chinese government abandoned the seafood market theory, and then scientists said, well, maybe it came from frozen fish sticks from Norway. And, you know, it just got super politicized.
Frozen fish sticks from Norway. That's a good one.
That's an actual example. Yeah. So, I mean, when you think about it, and that's one of the things the WHO is investigating.
I guess I'm not trusting the Gorton's fishermen anymore.
They call it some people call it the popsicle theory, you know, but the idea is that, you know, because of the way things were going in that time in our politics, it was really hard to have an honest discussion about what are the real theories and what's the evidence against them. And, you know, if you look at it without the sort of the Trump part of it, without the Trump stink on it, if you will.
It's like, I can't tell you.
People don't want to agree with Trump. I get that, right?
You introduce the word Trump or whatever, and everybody like, you know.
But Trump's not president anymore.
All right, now I'm going to introduce you an idea that doesn't use his name. Anyway, go ahead.
What I did was I went to the Biden people and I said, hey, listen, these claims that Trump and Pompeo made about the Wuhan lab, are they true? Does the intelligence bear them out? And what they came back with was very honest and very interesting. And the State Department told me, listen, the claims about the lab's suspicious activities and the sickness at the lab and these other circumstantial points are factually true. But we don't agree with Trump that this means that the lab probably did it. In other words, the Biden administration is taking a very even-handed approach and calling for more information and expressing deep concerns about the WHO investigation, which includes some of the investigators being best friends of the people at the lab and their funders, you know, which seems to me to be a conflict of interest. And they're just saying, listen, we need to follow the data and we need to follow the science and we need to investigate all the possible theories. So, you know, this book is an attempt to depoliticize this issue, if that's at all possible.
Right.
And the point here is that, you know, the origin of the coronavirus is not about blame. It's about scientific information that we need so we can prevent the next pandemic.
More. I mean, tell us about this Wuhan lab.
So the Wuhan Institute of Virology was the world's leading center for bat coronavirus research. And in 2018, U.S. diplomats went there and wrote back two cables back to Washington that were ignored that expressed concerns about the lab. The scientists said they didn't have enough safety equipment and enough staff to run it safely. They were specifically concerned in these cables about their research on bat coronaviruses that can infect human beings. And that's what they wrote. And 3 years later, when a bat coronavirus that infects human beings really well broke out in the same city as those labs, a lot of people inside the U.S. government were like, wait a second, we need to take a look at this, okay? But then once that story broke, it got so politicized that they couldn't really say anything out loud, and the intelligence community really doesn't know either way, you know what I mean? There's an intelligence gap. It's not like they know it was a market, and people always get confused because they say, oh, well, it's a natural virus, but the theory is not that the virus was engineered per se. The theory is that this lab had a bunch of bat coronaviruses, which they were running experiments on. So, of course, they would look like natural viruses, but maybe something happened and maybe there was some human error. Maybe there was an accident, not a bioweapon, but an accident. And again, I'm not saying that's what happened. I'm just saying that the people who want to get to the bottom of that include the people in the Biden administration who have no allegiance to one theory or the other. They weren't even in government at the time. And I think now that Trump is gone, everyone should just take a step back for a second and take a breath and just say, okay, listen, this is not actually a political question, okay? The virus is not a Republican. The virus is not a Democrat. It's not pro-Trump. It's not anti-Trump. Yeah. You know, something happened here that made the world sick, and we need to figure out what it was so that we can make sure it doesn't happen again. The Chinese won't release the data and won't give access to the lab, and that's a huge problem.
Well, the only reason Chernobyl was ever made is because not the Russians or the Soviets, but the Ukrainian government finally released the facts on what happened. And that's why Chernobyl has – that's why they were able to tell that story 30 years later. The point is we may have to wait – who knows how long we have to wait to get the real story on what happened and what.
And it's a real tragedy because that information could also be used to save lives today. And it's a pattern of what the Chinese government did during the pandemic, including when Xi Jinping lied to President Trump and told him the virus would go away in warm weather and that it was healable by herbal medicine.
With Xi, I mean, Trump's habit of repeating whatever the last thing he hears even went as far as Xi, right?
President Xi was the best at putting stuff in Trump's hearing.
I was going to say, especially if it was already, like you point out in the book, Trump wants this virus to go away. So if Xi told him it was going to go away, then he felt even better about it. Right?
Sorry, Chuck, you cut out for a second. I know we're taping.
No. You were saying, you said, like you even wrote this in the book, that in many ways, Xi knew what Trump wanted to hear and he kept telling him.
Yes. He fed his ego. He fed his desire to minimize the pandemic. And we know why Trump didn't want the pandemic to be real, because he wanted the economy to roar through and get him reelected. And this threatened everything that he had been working for. So he wanted to hear that it was not a big deal. She told him it was not a big deal. He put that information into his head with all of the other information that he was getting, and it became a garbled mess. And that's why it was a garbled mess when it came out of his mouth. And that's why our policy in the pandemic was a garbled mess. And when you just think of what that meant for our response and how much more suffering. And that doesn't absolve the Trump administration from the mistakes they made, right? It was his job not to listen to President Xi. It was his job to listen to the national security experts and the health experts. And he didn't do that. So I'm not absolving Trump of any of that. I'm just saying that part of the blame was on the Chinese president for lying to him in the first place.
Right. Which, of course, though, this was always the great fear of Trump, is that he was very easily manipulated by whoever's in the room at any given time.
Absolutely.
At the end of the Biden 4 years, what do you expect the relationship to be?
you know, the best outcome at the end of the Biden 4 years would be a relationship that doesn't have to be 100% good or 100% bad all the time, where we have an ability to have relations between Washington and Beijing, but we're not looking the other way at all of their atrocities and worst behavior. And we can't seem to do that in our politics right now. We can't seem to have two complex thoughts in our head at once. We have to confront Chinese bad behavior, but we also have to work with China, and we have to separate the Chinese people and the, you know, especially not target Chinese or Chinese Americans. And, you know, we have to be very careful not to let politics, our political and diplomacy with China, you know, fuel any hate or attacks against minorities in our country. And we have to do all of those things at once. And that's very complicated. And the best hope that I could see is that the Biden administration finds a way to walk and chew gum, where we can have a tough China policy that doesn't go too far and doesn't lead to conflict and doesn't result in our country not living up to our values and our ideals. Now, that I don't know if that's going to happen, but that's what I'd love to see.
Well, you, I love how you also talk about that everybody has their awakening moment when it comes to China, and that in some ways you want this book to serve as a, it sounds like a wake up call that, hey, no matter all the problems, you know, China's first, second, and third on the priority list. Everything else flows from there.
Yeah, I think people around America are starting to ask themselves, okay, well, what does it mean that the Chinese government is present on our campuses and in our markets and in, Hollywood and in Silicon Valley? Is that a problem? When is it a problem, you know? And so I think that's a national conversation that we all have to have. And I think that is now happening. And hopefully the book can add a bit to that conversation.
That doesn't slip into the Red Scare, though.
Well, that's what I argue very strenuously in the book, is that there is a risk that we overreact, and we can't become the thing that we're fighting, and we have to be true to our own values, and we have to depoliticize this, because yes, you could go too far, and that would not be in the interests of China or the United States. So, you know, that's what makes the China challenge so complex, but that's why everyone has to get involved.
Well, look. Josh, congratulations. It's nice. Thank you. I think it's hard to write about China in a lively way. It is hard to get, you know, this is a necessary book, I think, for active people in American politics need to read. And it's also not a hard book to read. And I don't say a meaning that you wrote it in an accessible way on a topic that can feel inaccessible to people. So with that,
thanks, John.
To me, that to me was probably your greatest challenge. You also must have had a pretty good editor too. I'm not saying you're not a good writer. I think you are, but you also
amazing team in HMH. They did a great job with it.
I really was impressed, because again, these books are not easy to make, easy reads, and I mean this as a compliment. So, congratulations, my friend.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Chuck Todcast from Meet the Press. Today's episode was produced by Justice Green, Matt Rivera, and Megan Leibowitz. John Reese is our executive producer. Our theme music is composed by Spoke Media. You can catch Meet the Press daily on MSNBC every day at 1. Meet the Press Reports is on demand on Peacock. And The Big Show is every Sunday morning. So thanks for listening, and until we upload again.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.